This week, virtually every asset class struggled except U.S. financial shares. Welcome back, everyone. It's a pleasure to have you with us for another big show. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with you. We have two must-hear guests. This week's heavy hitters are as far apart on the spectrum as I think one can get. Professor Emeritus of Economics at Princeton University, home of the late John Nash, who incidentally knew John Nash, as he's pointed out in earlier conversations on the show, says market forecasting is bunk. It's a waste of time. On the other hand, Michael Belkin, a gold stock analyst, thinks there's plenty of opportunity to outperform the markets if you know where to look. You decide. First at bat, Dr. Mal Keel, the author of A Random Walk Down Wall Street, says no to gurus, analysts, or forecasters. He says, you know, nothing can beat a solid, diversified portfolio. In fact, he says, trying to outsmart the markets, most investors end up in a far worse situation. He also offers a unique life cycle fund, or target fund, that I think many folks will be interested in. It automatically adjusts a portfolio allocation based on individual age and expected lifespan. Michael Belkin of the Belkin Report and the new Belkin Gold Stock Forecast makes his debut on the show. He's advising his clients and hedge funds to rotate out of U.S. equities and into his hand-picked gold stocks, many of which are up 100 to 300%, but he admits, and I think this is key, that picking the ones that are going to skyrocket is challenging. He likes for folks to have a portfolio of at least 20 of these stocks in order to catch the big gains in just a few of them. The gold stock guru shares several of his favorite stock ticker symbols. His model showing a forceful gold stock rally is imminent, after which many investors will start to pile into the market. And he thinks the bear market in gold and silver equity is over. And we'd like for you to call into our new hotline 24/7. You can do so. It's not toll-free. We'd like for you to leave your first name, or you can stay anonymous if you'd like. The Q&A hotline 1-206-666-5370. And then Robert Ian brings all of the runners across home plate with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek begins now with a market recapitulation. Well, partly cloudy skies appeared this week in the precious metals sector. Investors chose the sidelines amid surprise dollar strength on Friday. And at the closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was off about $22, ending at $11.68. Silver gave back about 73 cents, finishing at $15.98. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index fell 2 points, about 3%, ending at $67.72, while West Texas Intermediate Crude dropped a dollar, finishing near $59 a barrel. The top story driving the markets this week stemmed from the Eurozone. The Greek debt showdown intensified. According to one media report, the Greek banking system is in dire jeopardy of complete failure, with bank runs on the rise as depositors pulled out over $700 million on Friday alone, $300 million on Thursday. That's $1 billion in just 48 hours. On the same day, Greek officials delayed repayment of $300 million to the International Monetary Fund until the end of the month, and that increased default concerns. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras demanded accommodation with some of these tough terms they see in the Eurozone. Turning to domestic news, according to a Commerce Department report, the U.S. economy added about 250,000 new jobs in May. That was the biggest jump since the end of 2014 and well above the consensus forecast. Nevertheless, the unemployment rate actually ticked up 0.1% to 5.5%. In addition, wage growth is steady, though, adding some wiggle room for the Federal Reserve to increase rates later this year. The Fed is now expected to increase rates in either September or the December meeting. They've held rates near zero since December of 2008. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, although virtually every asset class fell this week, and I do mean almost every, there were a few sectors that bucked the trend. The U.S. dollar did stage a big rally on Friday, and I think that wiped away much of the losses. And I think this increases some of the downside risk in many sectors, like the big cap bellwether blue chip stocks, as well as the precious metals. I think caution is advisable until the Fed rate hike decision is passed. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, heavy cloud cover was seen over the New York Stock Exchange on Friday. Investors chose the sidelines amid the stronger-than-expected employment figures in anticipation of a Fed rate hike this fall. The Dow Jones Industrials ended at 17,849, off about 161 points. The S&P 500 finished at 2092, down 15 points. And the NASDAQ closed near break-even, off just fractionally at 5068, as investors turned away from the bellwethers in favor of the oversold tech sector. Although economic indicators are mixed here, solid trade figures and improved auto sales suggest that, on the whole, the economy is chugging along. In addition, there is virtually unanimous agreement among Fed officials that the benchmark lending rate will increase later this year. That's the first hike since December 2008. And, of course, if the Fed is planning to raise rates, they know something that many other folks don't, and that is the economy is much stronger than many people believe. Even short-term, 10-year, 2-year, 1-year, and 30-year T-bonds suffered this week. It was just across the spectrum a difficult week. However, the S&P 500 Financials Index added about 0.5% on Friday on expectations that the rate hike could boost some portions of their profit margin. Shares of Goldman Sachs blasted higher to a new all-time high on Friday, closing at $210 per share, while J.P. Morgan Chase posted the biggest gain in the Dow, adding about $1 to about $67 a share. Small caps also outperformed bellwether stocks as U.S. dollar strength lowered U.S. corporate export competitiveness. Bottom line on Wall Street, the 7-indicator sentiment index remains in the mildly fearful camp, but no signs of capitulation appeared. One positive was the divergence between the NASDAQ and the blue chips, as I mentioned. I think this shows signs of accumulation in the tech sector, typical of sector rotation in a forceful bull market. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Michael Belkin and Professor Emeritus from Princeton, Dr. Burton Malkiel. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Michael Belkin started his career in the equity department at Salomon Brothers, currently the president of Belkin Limited, a financial and economic forecasting firm, advises hedge funds, institutions, top investors around the globe. You can find out more from the Belkin Report. I've got a copy here on the desktop. Welcome, Michael Belkin.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
I'm looking at some of these picks. Your gold and silver stocks, every one of which that I can find here, is up 100% in 2015 alone. And these aren't just penny stocks. I'm looking at a $50 gold stock that's doubled in 2015.
Well, I have a forecasting model. My background is in systematic trading. I came out of the UC Berkeley Business School, and I'm basically applying econometric models to forecasting. That got me into Salomon Brothers. I ended up in proprietary trading. We were running the equity account, directional trading in global markets in the Michael Lewis Liar's Poker era. I've been doing the Belkin Report ever since then, so 1992. It's 23 years now, a long time. So I advise hedge funds, and I give forecasts. My model gives forecasts for different asset classes. Put it in a nutshell, I think that the equity markets are in a huge bubble. My colleague Janet Yellen, Berkeley Business School, she has pumped up a bubble just like we had in 2007. At the peak or at the tech bubble, at the top in 2000. And so I'm down on stocks in general. However, the gold space topped out in 2011. And while the dollar rallied, gold stocks declined for, about 4 years or so. And the index, XAU, GDX, things like that went down about 70%. But a lot of gold stocks, individual gold stocks, went down in excess of 80, 90%. And that's where you find real bargains. If there's one thing I've learned over the years, it's when something's down 90%, you got to take a look at it. Maybe it's going to go bankrupt, but you don't want to touch it. But a lot of times, that's where the real bargains are. And when something has that big of a decline, you can get these doubles, triples, quadruples, which are just little blips on the chart. But, if something goes up 300%, that's not insignificant. And, it's difficult to catch the absolute bottom. But what I've been advising my institutional clients is to sell equities, not gold stocks, but, tech stocks, et cetera, cyclical stocks, financials, and rotate into depressed gold shares. So what I've noticed is a lot of these names that have been on our list are up, 100, 200% or something from their absolute lows that were set over the last 18 months. They all happened at different times, but a lot of them happened about 7 months ago or so, in late 2014. And so that's it in a nutshell. I think, you know, gold is negatively correlated to the stock market. I think you should be careful in, you know, in any kind of S&P 500 exposure, anything like that, Russell, Dow, NASDAQ, any kind of tech stocks. So this week's report in my Belkin report, which is for institutional investors, I have a list of 104 stocks on my sell list that are down an average 24% from their peak. So even though the indexes are up there near their peak, you know, the NASDAQ hit a new high in the last few weeks, S&P, Dow, you know, they're very close to their all-time highs, but a lot of individual stocks have sold off. You know, they peaked out months ago and they're declining. Those are names like Yahoo, Twitter. Yahoo's down 17% from its peak. Twitter down 47%. Google's down 11% from its peak. United Airlines down 25%. Southwest Airlines down 20%. Limited Brands, Retailer down 10%. Gap Store's down 17%. Walmart's down 17% from its these are all from their recent peaks, you know, established in the last 6 months or so. Dillard Department Store's down 18%. Tech stocks like Seagate Technology down 19% from its peak. Network Appliances down 25%. Hewlett Packard down 18%. So it's a deceptive market. You know, if you just looked at the news, you'd think, oh, the market's doing great. But what's happening is portfolio managers are getting singed by individual names that are declining while the index hits new highs. So that's my strategy in a nutshell. Sell and short tech stocks and cyclicals. Buy gold shares. That's what I'm telling my institutional investors.
Certainly been working out for you. We see this precarious looking sideways action. Every time the bulls try to muster a rally, it turns out to be a little more than a short covering rally, and then we're right back down to those lows again. We've just been hovering in a tighter and tighter range. Typically, two-thirds to even three-fourths of the time, that downward consolidation will lead to a capitulation moment. Are you looking for something like that, as so many of the analysts on the show are? Are you in Peter Schiff's camp, convinced the bottom was in 2014 for the precious metals?
Yeah, I do think that. So it's particularly obvious on the individual stocks. Again, so as in the stock market where the indexes are bouncing around their highs, but a lot of stocks are declining already, you know, significantly down 20%, a lot of them on average. In gold shares, it's the opposite.
It's really the divergences between the individual components and the indices that you're watching most closely. That's an interesting forward indicator.
Right. So the stocks themselves, not all of them, but a lot of them, and this is what I try to identify with my model. So I have a retail product that I've just come out with called the Belkin Gold Stock Forecast, which is affordable. My institutional investor, Belkin Report, which I've been doing for 23 years now, is on the expensive side, is for big institutions. But, you know, this is the first new product I've had, you know, in 23 years, and I'm taking a bold stand because I think that these gold shares offer a tremendous opportunity. They're really washed out. They're starting to come back to life. And I think what I'm trying to do is help identify, you know, if you hold a portfolio of these things, I won't be right on every one of them, but, you know, at a portfolio of 20, 30 stocks, you know, I think there's the potential for these doubles and triples and stuff. Yes, I think the stocks, if you look at the gold price, it bottomed out in the middle of 2014. The GDX bottomed, looks like to me, you know, it hit a lower low, kind of hit in the middle of the year, last year, and then hit a slightly higher low in late, you know, in the end of last year, and every little low has been a little bit higher. That's for the individual, that's for the ETF. And that, you know, so I drill down and I check out the components of the GDX and the GDXJ, and also in Australia and, you know, and London listed names as well. And I try to identify with my model stocks that will outperform the index and the GDX and the GDXJ. And it's been working reasonably well. You know, like I said, every stock won't, it's not like a 100% success ratio, but I'm trying to get 75% success ratio. That's what I aim at.
Well, a 750 batting average is certainly enough to get to the all-stars. So, well, these smaller companies aren't beholden to those institutions that are forced to gobble up huge shares of the bellwether stocks in an index. They're not tied to futures contracts. They're not indexed, offering great potential here as an indicator as well as a portfolio beta and alpha booster.
I was on this Minds and Money conference circuit. You know, I've spoken about four of these things. They had me, I was the global macro expert, you know, and they flew me to Melbourne, Australia, Hong Kong, London twice. You know, I've been saying for a year, about 18 months since they put me on this circuit, you know, sell basic materials, things like that, that are economically sensitive. So the global view is that, you know, I think we're headed into a downturn economically. You know, the China boom has faded. That was what drove investment, you know, foreign investment. You were supposed to invest in emerging markets that sold to China. That whole thing's been totally discredited. So I think, you know, you kind of alluded to this, where big institutions, who are my clients, you know, big, you know, hedge funds, you know, sovereign wealth funds, things like that, those are my clients. When they begin, I think they're just kind of tipping their toes in the water of gold investments at the moment. But when they begin to steer more money into this, is what I believe will happen. We'll be in a bear market in stocks. They'll be looking for things that work. They'll be kind of scooping these things up. So I think as an individual investor, you can sort of front run the institutions. They're still in la-la land, you know, drinking Federal Reserve Kool-Aid, QE Kool-Aid. But I'll just run down a few names. So in Australia, you know, I've had, here's PRU. These are all Australian listed. PRU is a ticker. Perseus Mining, it's up 105% from its low. Dragon Mining, DRA symbol, and these are all Australia, up 100% from its low. Ramelius Resources, RMS, up 225% from its low. Northern Star, NST, up 252% from its low. Saracen Mining, SAR, plus 179% from its low. I could go on and long, but that's a half of them in Australia. Those are all still, I still recommend those, even though they've doubled. It's kind of a little blip off the lows. There's others that I have in my Belkin Gold Stock Forecast. There aren't that many London-listed gold stocks. I have a lot of clients in London, actually. I just got back from there visiting them. Also, Acacia Mining, it's the old American Barrick. That's up 95% year-to-date. And Centamin Egyptian, it's a London-listed Egyptian mining company, up 75% year-to-date. So across the board, I see this, you know, these stocks have basically doubled this year, you know, in the last 6 months or so. And in Canada, names like Guiana Gold Fields, G-U-Y symbol, Kirkland Lake Gold, K-G-I symbol, China Gold Fields, up 73%. Kirkland's up 194%. Guiana's up 134%. Lakeshore Gold up 181%, symbol LSG. Fortuna Silver Mines up 76% year-to-date, FVI symbol. And Oceana Gold up 100%, OGG.TO. Basically, you talked about the gold assets sort of bouncing along the bottom. And I think we're 2% below the 200-day average on silver and gold. So in spot gold, that's about 1215. We're at 1193 or so at the moment. That's 2% above. And the 200-day average in silver is around $17. We're around 1680. And then the GDX, its 200-day average is 20.5. We're 2% below there. So what I'm expecting to happen is for them to break out above that level in the not-too-distant future. Don't ask me exactly when. I don't have a precise moment or day or time or day of the week or anything, but soon. And I think that will ignite a lot of inflows. It will begin to set off technical buy signals, and we'll begin to see some more institutional interest, you know, empty promise gold mining companies. But these are all, you know, pretty substantial exploration or producing companies that are in the GDX or GDXJ for the most part. And the Australian ones are the top 20, 25 in the country. So I think that institutional investors will begin to flock into this. And I think you can front run them and be, you know, I think that they will ignite, you know, when the big money starts to go into this stuff, into gold, silver, and gold mining and silver mining stocks, where the real lift will come from.
Clearly, you see this huge global bubble. It's obviously the result of all this QE Kool-Aid. I like that term. That money has to flow somewhere when the smart money, the deep pockets, realize there are too many in this herd moving in one direction. And we've had, as you know, since 2009, a spectacular bull market. You seem to think that might be nearing an end.
Yes, I do. Now, I'm not a perma bear on stocks. Back in 2009, all the reports I was writing at this time of the year, April, May, June 2009, I was absolutely bullish. At that time, the stock market and financials and tech stocks were like gold stocks are now. They were crushed. You know, they were down 80-90%. That was the time to buy the market. After 6 years of this, of zero interest rates, you know, we're on the end of this long experiment, and everyone has kind of gone to sleep up here at the top. You know, when I talk to hedge fund managers and institutional investors, they're squeezed into this psychology of that, well, I got to be invested even though I know it's a bubble, and because my investors, if I'm not participating, then my investors will pull the money from my fund, blah, blah, blah. That's very vulnerable, because if when the market starts to break, they know, you know, they all have technical levels where they will begin to take action. You know, they'll begin to sell and short.
Okay, but let me throw a wrench into the works here, because you've outlined, you know, an excellent battle plan here for us all. Okay, we're ready to go into combat. However, what if or what happens when the Fed pulls the trigger on rates September or December?
You know, they're talking about it. I would be surprised if they actually ever do it. You know, I mean, they backed themselves into a corner with zero interest rates and QE, even though the QE is over at the moment. I think the bigger influence is the global economic downturn. Okay, so we are 3 years approximately longer than the average economic expansion at the moment. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, the China boom is over. Anybody that was exporting stuff to China, all that is over. The dollar has been stronger, and that's hurting. So corporate earnings are falling. And so I think the bigger risk, rather than interest rate rise, is an economic downturn. So, and that's, you know, when companies start telling you that we're not going to hit our earnings, our revenues are falling, which is already happening. You know, we're two quarters into this. That is what drives the stock market down. You know, historically, the Dow Jones, this is one of the first projects I did at Salomon Brothers when Laszlo Perini hired me in there. I overlaid recession bands with the Dow Jones going back to the 1800s. And, you know, stock market trades down in a recession. So basically, I'm expecting an economic downturn. It's not the end of the world, you know, but and that will drive the stock market down. And I believe that gold has already had its bear market, so gold will begin to come back. Again, we've had the bear market already in this, you know, like we've had from the peak in 2011 to the low at late last year, you know, down 70% in the gold share indexes, and then down 90% in a lot of gold shares. So I think we've already had the stuffing knocked out of that. You know, the only other asset class in the world that's down this much is the Greek stock market. And Greece is almost a buy, you know, to me. I think the Greek stock market is down 95% in U.S. dollars from its peak. But the Greek stock market could become a buy if they leave the euro. Ironically, everybody thinks it will be dangerous, but I don't. I think that it would be like Iceland, where Iceland left and it turns into a big devaluation rally. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a favor of monetary debasement, but I think that's the only answer for Greece at this point. In this cycle, gold is extremely depressed. Gold shares are extremely depressed. And when the economy weakens, if my scenario is correct, we know that central banks only have one answer to everything: print more money. You know, we can safely assume that instead of raising interest rates, central bankers and the European Central Bank, and not right away, not tomorrow morning, but if the economy weakens, these guys will be dumping money from helicopters again. And that is probably what will ignite. That's further down the line after gold has already made its bottom and started recovering.
Look at the Fed's numbers, and given their balance sheet, clearly it hasn't really rolled over all that much yet. So they still haven't pulled in all of their QE reins, it would seem. So even if they did pull the trigger, maybe just to save face, maybe just a token amount, you seem to think behind the scenes, you know, it's going to be business as usual.
So Bernanke, you know, his research, his academic research before he went to the Fed was all about preventing the Great Depression. You know, it's like how, and I think he's completely wrong in his analysis and his conclusions. You know, he said that if they'd only printed more money, then we wouldn't have had the Great Depression. You know, that's sort of the Milton Friedman idea.
Really, if you look back at the 20s, that's what they had done. They'd printed money like mad. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. So I think it's a misformed analysis, but that is how they think.
On the one hand, you are absolutely right. It wouldn't have kept us from having a Great Depression. It probably would have saved the stock market from an 89% implosion, just ignited this economic boom much earlier, and we'd probably be in the situation we're in, the quagmire, much sooner.
Right. Well, they did print a lot of money. You know, if you read, there's a great book on that period called The Crash and Its Aftermath by Barry Wigmore. He was a partner at Goldman Sachs. But not that I'm endorsing Goldman Sachs, but it's a very good book. And, you know, he goes over, you know, month by month, year by year, what happened. And they were printing money, you know, and the stock market went down anyways. So when you have a artificial investment, malinvestment boom created by easy credit, when it comes unglued, there's no stopping it. My analysis is based for, you know, the Austrian view. And when you have a malinvestment boom, it's got to be liquidated. So one way or the other, they don't want it to happen. They want it, you know, trees to grow to the sky. But something goes wrong. Just like in 2008, you have this leveraged Ponzi scheme, and some big leveraged player goes belly up, and then it leads to a round of defaults and deleveraging. So that's what caused, you know, margin debt was up 7% in April. They just announced it. So they're still in, the market was hardly up. The stock market was up less than 1%. In the down cycle is deleveraging. So that hasn't started to happen yet. But, when the price of an asset falls, somebody gets a margin call, they have to sell, it drives the price down further. Somebody else gets a margin call, and you get into this vortex of liquidation.
Do you have any good news then for our bullion investors? I mean, do you expect there to be a resurgence or revival? Will the phoenix rise from the ashes? Will we see another, explosive rally? Or is that sort of an end game question mark?
The physical gold is, I think it's set to rise above its 200-day, and then that will probably ignite a round of buying that will take it a lot higher. I just think the leverage is in the gold, the pressed gold shares, so if gold goes up 10%, a lot of these gold shares could triple, you know, because they're leveraged to the price of gold. So I just think that the gold mining, legitimate gold mining companies that are not going to go bankrupt, you know, ones with sound finances and good investment, you know, because one thing that happens when the gold price goes up, your reserves become more economic. So, you know, a reserve that's not worth mining at, you know, $1,190 at 1200 or $1,300, your reserves have gone up enormously.
Are you expecting new highs in the precious metals bull market in the years to come?
Yes, absolutely. But I mean, that's the flip side of that is, what do you think is going to happen to money and to every currency, you know? And the central planners out there, you know, they want to come up with a new world SDR, you know, to replace the dollar as the reserve currency. So there's all these plans that they're hatching, you know, to include the Chinese yuan and other things. And basically it's currency debasement by any name, you know, any other name, however you want to, whatever you want to call it. So I have the utmost faith in central banks to continue messing up the credit system and printing money and debasing currency, monetary debasement. That's their game. And you know, gold is the flip side of it. You can't debase gold. So I think I'm not predicting the end of the world, but, you know, it's the counterpart to whatever they do. I think actually, you know, they will include gold in part of their, you know, that's part of, you know, what the BIS uses as reserves. So they think it's money. And I think that you know, I think that it's a good counterpoint to currency that is being debased.
Why don't you tell folks more about the services you provide, the newsletter, and any other contact information?
Yeah, so if you Google the Belkin Gold Stock Forecast, that's my new report. It's a biweekly report. It's affordable for institutional investors, you know, and it's Hypernion Partners. You can buy it. You can subscribe online. Everything's automated. It's a brand new product. Comes out every 2 weeks. The Belkin report I've been doing for 23 years. It's a high end. It's for institutional investors, you know, big institutions. It's kind of it's rather expensive. So my clients are you know, big hedge funds in New York, London, places like that, mutual fund companies in Boston. But Google the Belkin report and the Belkin Gold Stock Forecast, and you'll be taken directly to the subscription.
Well, I have a copy right here. I want to endorse it here for all of our listeners. And, of course, our sponsor I have to endorse as well, Peter Spina, the Gold Forecaster, for our gold aficionados and gold stock aficionados as well. Really like to have you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
It's great. Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have Professor Burton Malkiel on the show, the Professor of Economics Emeritus and Senior Economist at Princeton University, author of A Random Walk Down Wall Street, a must-read for every investor. Welcome back, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Talk today about predictions and forecasts. You have gone on record with very interesting stance on this, and there are so many folks out there, gurus and analysts, with their opinions on the markets. Could you tell us more?
One of the things I think we know is that no one and I really mean no one can predict what's going to happen to the market over the next day, the next week, the next few months, the next year. I have been in this business for over 50 years. I have never known anyone who could time the market. Indeed, I've never known anyone who knows anyone who could time the market. So I think one of the lessons that we really should keep in mind is no one knows where the market's going to go. And it's even worse than that, because when we try to do it, we're much more likely to get it wrong than right. Our emotions get a hold of us, and we tend then to buy when everyone is optimistic and sell when everyone is pessimistic. When you look at the money that's flowed into equity mutual funds, more money went in at the height of the internet bubble in early 2000 than ever before. And then when did it go out? It went in at the top. When did it go out? In the third quarter of 2008, at the kind of height of the financial crisis, we basically found that people took their money out. So it was exactly the time. Don't try to time the market. You can't do it. Nobody can do it. Professionals can't do it. The government can't do it. And when you try to do it, you're more likely to get it wrong than right.
It really does, though, have a silver lining. You can prepare. Just because we don't know the future doesn't mean we can't benefit from the fact that we know virtually nothing about tomorrow, let alone next year. And you give us the key to a very successful formula.
There are two things you can do in the face of not being able to predict. One is you can just put money in period after period, as you do with a 401k plan at work. You will sometimes buy at the high, but you'll also sometimes buy at the low. And by so-called dollar cost averaging, what you find is that you get actually an average cost for your shares that's below the average of the prices at which you buy. And the reason for that is that when the market is low, you tend to buy more shares than when the market is high. And therefore, your average cost tends to be lower than the average of the prices, because you're buying more shares when the price is low. And the way this works is, take a decade, which we think was a terrible decade for the stock market, the first decade of the 2000s, when the market actually ended up just about the same place where it started. And some people say you couldn't make a nickel out of the stock market in the first decade of the 2000s. Well, if you dollar cost averaged, that is to say, you just every couple of weeks or every paycheck or every quarter, you put the same amount in, you actually had a pretty good return, even in that lost decade. Why? Because when the market was low, as it was in 2002 and 2003 and 2007, 2008, you were buying more shares. And even though the market as a whole ended up exactly where it was at the beginning, you could make money by that technique. So, in other words, use not being able to predict the market to work in your favor. Dollar cost averaging is the way to go. So I recommend to people, look, it's very important that you save for your retirement. You don't know today if the market's too high or too low, but start this regular savings plan, and over the long pull, it's been known to work and to work well.
May not be the sexy advice that people are looking for, but the statistics certainly support this as the best way to go. And you also have talked about stock valuations. You're on the show about 6 months ago, and you aptly pointed out the CAPE index, price to earnings metric, pointing to overvaluation, and we just haven't seen much forward progress since then. Are you sticking with your analysis?
What has happened is, I think all assets are very highly priced today. And they're highly priced today because the government is setting the base rate, which is the rate at which perfectly safe Treasury securities sell, at a very, very low rate. They have basically set the short-term rate at zero, and the 10-year Treasury sells for a yield that's just over 2%. That has remained. That suggests that returns are going to be somewhat lower in the future. And what that means is, if you're saving for retirement, it's extremely important that you put money aside. You may even have to put more money aside to guarantee that you're going to be able to live with a comfortable retirement. So, yes, market prices are high. Valuations are above average. Yields or returns are probably below average. That's the situation that we all have to live with.
You've mentioned indexing, and you're obviously a big fan of, and obviously keeping expenses low, especially when yields are not as high as they have been in the past, and or returns for that matter. I wonder if you could give us an idea, this other topic you've brought up in the past, and that's target date funds, particularly with for folks who have 401ks, there's adjustment there between stock and bond exposure. Can you tell us more?
When you're young, when you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s even, you've got lots of time to ride out the ups and downs of the stock market, and you've got a lifetime of employment and therefore earnings ahead of you, and you can afford to take the risk of being very heavily, indeed even largely, invested in common stocks. But when you're in your late 60s or 70s, when you may be retired, when you don't have the earnings from employment to tide you over, if there's a reversal in the stock market, as there often is, stock markets fluctuate, they go up and down, at that point, you probably need a safer portfolio. And one that produces some amount of income that you're going to live on. So what the idea is that when you are older and in retirement, you want a somewhat safer portfolio. You want one that's somewhat less exposed to equities, one that is a more income-generating portfolio. And that is the kind of life cycle theory of investing that I think everybody should keep in mind. Now, what a life cycle fund does, what a target date fund does, is it will automatically move you over time as you age into this somewhat safer income-producing portfolio. It's a kind of set-it-and-forget-it type of portfolio. And for those who would like the simpler solution, it's a very serviceable one.
For our listeners who perhaps have a favorite guru or analyst or program that they watch for investment advice, and try to help people really sink their teeth into this idea that you've laid out so eloquently here regarding the frivolousness of trying to command the tides.
I have been an advocate of so-called indexing. That is to say, to put your money in a portfolio that simply buys and holds all the stocks in the market. I've been in favor of this in my book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, the first edition, even before index funds existed. And the evidence has just been extraordinary. One of the reasons that I do new editions and why the book's in its 11th edition now is that the instruments that are available today are totally different from what they were when I first wrote the book. There were no index funds. Then there were index funds. Now there are so-called exchange-traded funds that allow you to buy index funds that trade on the New York Stock Exchange. So the evidence that has been accumulating is just extraordinary, that this is not mediocre investing. This is not average investing. This is above average investing, because when you try to use one of the gurus or one of the fine portfolio managers that's going to knock the socks off the market, that's going to outperform, what you find is that they charge you at least 1 percentage point a year, sometimes 2 percentage points a year. An indexed ETF you can buy at essentially zero expense. 1/20 of 1% is the typical expense ratio of these funds. And when you look at the evidence, it's not average performance. It generally beats 80 to 90% of the active managers. In fact, that was the case last year. Over 80% of active managers were beaten by this low-cost index fund approach. I believe even more strongly than I did 40 years ago when I first wrote the book that this ought to be the core of every portfolio, a low-cost total stock market index fund. I believed it 40 years ago. I believe it even more now. And as the evidence accumulates, there's just no question in my mind that this kind of fund ought to be the core of your portfolio.
Very good. Asset classes. My guess is as you really start to balance a portfolio, give it a nice solid beta, you would also like to add some diversification among those asset classes, because there are times when even stocks and bonds aren't negatively correlated. In order to truly have a diversified portfolio, international exposure, commodities, things of that nature. Any thoughts there?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that one ought very much to do. Maybe start off with a U.S. portfolio, but remember the United States is only something like a quarter to a third of the world's economic activity. One ought to be diversified internationally, including diversified into the rapidly growing emerging economies of the world. One ought to have more asset classes than simply stocks and bonds. One asset class that I favor should be in each portfolio is some real estate investments, which are accessible through real estate investment trusts. And here, I believe in indexing, just as I do with regular common stocks. There are index funds of real estate investment trusts that diversify among commercial buildings, retail space, and so forth. So that's an asset class that ought to be in a portfolio. Broad diversification reduces risk, extremely important for investors as their portfolio grows.
Well, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, what a must read. This is a must read for everyone. I'll wager that it's the most supplemented or the most read text in virtually every business class across America. Even though it's not classified as a textbook, most professors would add that on to any financial course. It's just a pleasure to have you here today. Can you tell us if you are planning another edition? Will you be adding any more information?
Well, the 11th edition was published in January of this year, and I usually do one every 3 or 4 years. But right now, the current 11th edition with the yellow cover has the most recent and up-to-date information available.
Very good. We're going to put the text on our website. And we can't thank you enough, sir, for helping get people back on track with their portfolios. Professor Burton Malkiel, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Gerald Salente is director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal, slam-packed with must-read information. Welcome back, Gerald Salente.
Well, thanks for having me back, Chris.
You know, Zeke West sent over a copy of your latest Trends Journal, as I mentioned here. I'm going to put it euphemistically, alarming trends here that everyone needs to be aware of. Overriding theme in your journal seems to be war. And you know, our top guests on this show have recently all been alluding to the threat of just that beginning no later than perhaps the end of this year or 2015. Tell us your thoughts here, please.
It's hard to say when and how, but the why is pretty clear. And the why is something I've been writing about for years when the Panic of 08 began. I said there would never be a recovery, there'd be a cover-up. And they would cover it up with schemes undreamed of. And those schemes undreamed of were record low interest rates like we've never seen in our lifetime. Those schemes undreamed of were quantitative easing, not only in the United States. They have their own version in China and the European Central Bank as well. And then I said, when all else fails, they take you to war. It's a repeat of history. It never repeats itself exactly the same, but you have depressions, and then you have trade wars and currency wars, and then world wars. And in between that, you have a lot of regional scrimmages and civil wars. And that's what you're seeing breaking out now. In our Globalnomics section of the Trends Journal, we show the hot spots around the world. And they're all identified for everyone that wants to see them. And then what we did was we took the four corners of the world and we showed how it's all being waged around all of this, some of it making news and some of it not. So, of course, one of the ones was Ukraine. Another one we picked was Thailand. Hey, they had a military coup there, son of a gun. How do we know that was going to happen? Well, we've been watching it for several months now, and we wrote several months ago when it began that there'd be a military coup followed by a civil war. And then we wrote about Venezuela. Oh, today, news came out. Venezuela says that the United States has a plot to assassinate the president. And they have demonstrations going on there quite frequently. And they're running an inflation rate. I believe it's about 30-something percent. And then you look, the other one we picked was Nigeria. Wow. And that was long before the girls, the missing girls, the 300 or so girls that have been making the news. Why did we pick Nigeria? Well, because in Africa you have a lot of destabilization, a former colony of the European colony that was turned over again to a bunch of gangsters. They call themselves prime ministers or whatever, and kings and this and that. And they have 174 million people sitting on a lot of oil, and 40% of the people are making under a dollar a day. And so you could call them radical Islamists, you call them anything you want that are fighting against the corrupt government, but very easy to see. And then, of course, you start putting the pieces together. Thailand, Ukraine, Nigeria, Venezuela, Yemen, Somalia. You keep going around, Syria. And you can see it's a world in the throes of war, but that's not all of it. It's also the demonstrations that are going on in Italy and in Greece and in Spain and in Portugal that don't make the news here. Hey, did they find that airplane yet? You know, that one that they heard the pinger again for the 100th time. that CNN's been covering as a feature story even this week. So people don't see the dangers of what's going on. And as we tie it all together, Chris, we keep ending the story with, when people lose everything and have nothing left to lose, they lose it. And the other one is, far too few have much too much, and way too many have far too little. And that's what you're seeing going on around the world. They could call it anything they want, terrorism, fundamentalism. It's all comes down to the bottom line, and the bottom line is you got a lot of people out of work with nothing to lose, and they're losing it.
People want answers. They want to know what is at the root of this. I mean, on one hand, you say, well, you know, morally, we've become bankrupt. We're not based in the traditions of the past. On the other hand, we have folks who point to economics. As soon as you let the monetary, the Keynesian genie out of the bottle, all of your money becomes debased. And this is the first time in history that there hasn't been a single global currency backed by anything of substance. And eventually, that erodes all the confidence, and a few elite people at the top of the pyramid wind up with all the change, and the rest of us, we're left holding the mortgages and the paper. Is that how we got here, or is that an oversimplification?
No, it's not an oversimplification, but it's part of it, because then you have in other countries where that's not the issue. So it could be Egypt, it could be Colombia, it could be Venezuela, Argentina. So you have corruption. To me, morals, you know, I have to say it's the issue because it also gravitates to other levels. For example, back here in the States, President Obama just announced $5 billion for an anti-terrorism partnership with our allies. Oh, $5 billion. I read the same day they're going to take down 40,000, that's right, 40,000 structures, old factories and houses in Detroit. They're going to destroy them.
Just take a look at Detroit from any angle. You know, one worries if it isn't the Petri dish representing the rest of the nation here.
That's what I'm saying. Now, why is Detroit, what has happened to Detroit? You can't blame it on one thing or one person. It's a combination of unions and a combination of selling out our manufacturing, which they continue to do under the guise of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, that allows companies to get products made in slave labor companies, mark up the prices and bring them back home and resell them. And labor unions with these ridiculous things that they had with the auto industry and producing inferior cars. Hey, did you get your General Motors car recalled yet? I mean, look what's going on. And then the other point of this is the military. I don't support the troops. I want to make that clear. I am an American patriot. I'm here in Colonial Kingston, New York. I support a national defense force, not foreign entanglements. I do not support troops going to Afghanistan, to Yemen. Now they're sending them into Chad, into Nigeria. I don't approve of them going to Iraq. I don't approve of them going to Syria. I want a defense force. I am an American that stands on the principles upon which this nation was founded. No foreign entanglements. No foreign entanglements. They were going on back then. Yeah, with a 100 Years' War, this war, that war, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Adams, Franklin, all of the founding fathers, no foreign entanglements. So when you want to talk about the other part of this, Chris, listen to the words of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, 5-star general, supreme commander of the Allied forces in World War II, and, for the record, a 2-term president. He warns the nation that the military-industrial complex is robbing the nation of the genius of the scientists, the sweat of the laborers, and the future of the children. How much more proof do people need? When you look at the defense budget with NSA watching us, CIA listening to us, FBI tracking us, and you put it all together, you're at well over $1 trillion a year, getting flushed down the toilet. As Major General Smedley Butler, the most decorated man in American history before his death, warned, he said that war is a racket, and that's what it's become. So we could look at the other issues, the economic issues, but we have to look at what's happened to this nation. Look at the scandal going on now with the Veterans Administration. They use these poor people for cannon fodder, then they bring them back and they screw them. How much more is this? And look at the size of the budget for the VA. Look what we're doing to our soldiers, bringing them into foreign countries, into losing wars, coming back either in a casket or without arms, legs, or a mind.
If you bring this topic up to people, it becomes emotionally charged. On the one hand, if we pull out of these countries, there's going to be nothing but worldwide global chaos, and that's going to come back. There's going to be blowback.
Well, let's stop at that. Let's just stop at that and answer that question. Look what they did in Iraq. We're not there anymore. Wait, pick up the paper every day. Go to antiwar.com. Look at the numbers. 104 dead, 97 dead, 220 dead, day after day. You want to talk about chaos? What did the United States do by going in there? Destabilize the area. Chaos? Hey, all of you people that want to answer the question, try this one on for size. Does Libya fit you well? You remember that humanitarian mission? Or to use the language from the White House, time-limited, scope-limited, kinetic action. Oh, yeah, you want to talk about destabilization since they overthrew Gaddafi? Hey, you want to know why there's problems in Mali? Want to know why there's problems in Nigeria? Want to know why there's problems in Sudan? Want to know why all of those weapons that are now going into Syria, into the hands, and they're not only Islamic radicals. There are thousands of mafia groups that want a piece of the action, that have grabbed a hold of the situation in the midst of the chaos. Look, you can't go to Libya now. They're closing down the embassies and telling the people to come home. You could go there under Gaddafi. He wasn't bothering anybody.
Really, what I wanted to touch on here, though, was I'd like to examine just what would happen if we decided to bring our troops home. I mean, there's something like, at last check, well over 100 military bases.
700.
700 military bases. And we're not talking little, McDonald's or Wendy's restaurants here. This takes a huge, vast network of wealth and resources that the taxpayer has to pay. But let's step back for a minute and let's pull our troops out, close down the 700 bases. Well, we're going to cause massive unemployment in the United States if we do that. Really? Are you so sure of that? What would start to happen over time? You know, would we suddenly have more folks at home to build up our economy who would also be better educated and have entrepreneurial ideas of their own? And would we not have a sea change of improved sentiment towards the United States from the rest of the world who says, hey, maybe these guys aren't a bunch of militaristic, bombastic monsters after all?
Yeah, I think you wrapped it up well, and I agree with you. One of the movements I'm starting, by the way, and it's in the Trends Journal, it's called Occupy Peace. And I want to make this clear. If anybody's ever watched my videos, you know, I do Trends in the News each night, each weekday night, and they're on YouTube. We paste them up there. I'm a close combat practitioner. I'm not a pacifist. And I don't start trouble, and I don't look for trouble. If somebody tries to attack me, I'll do what I have to do.
It's common sense. I mean, everybody's read Sun Tzu. I mean, what is it, 70 pages long? If you haven't read Sun Tzu, you can't be an investor, and you certainly can't be in business because, I mean, it's the basics of business, and you summed it up perfectly. I mean, he makes it very, very, very clear. You never go to war unless victory is assured and it's absolutely necessary.
And so here's what I'm coming up with. It's called OccupyPeace.us. Anybody could go to the website and sign up. We're just putting it in order now. But the site is up. And the purpose of this is it's based on three words: no foreign entanglements, rebuild America. So now we close down all these bases. We bring the troops home. and now we close down our borders. I'm not xenophobic. I'm just non-interventionist. I'm not an isolationist. I travel the world. I believe in, you know, doing business with ever who you want to do business with. But I also believe we have too many people in this country, and we can't take care of our own right now, and we don't need any more. And all they're doing is driving down the wages by bringing in cheap labor, whether it's in the tech industry with their H-1B visas or bringing in other cheap labor. And when you look at the history of this country during the Depression, up until well after World War II, the borders were closed. Very few were allowed to come in. We need to rebuild America. I don't want my money going to Israel. I don't want it going to Italy. And I'm of Italian descent. I don't want it going to Ireland. And I love Irish women. I don't want it going to Ukraine. I don't want it going anywhere. I want it going to America and Americans. I want it going to Camden. I want it going to Detroit. Look at our internet system. It is third world. Do you know we rank right near the bottom when it comes to internet service? Yeah. Foreigners, and we're the people that brought it to the forefront. And now, look at our... You travel the world, you come back to JFK. Where do I land in Bangladesh? When you go to the other airports, look at our rail system. It's a disgrace.
No, the infrastructure is crumbling. And once again, you know, this is because, first of all, we've been misled by a media that is controlled by a few elite, okay? I mean, they have just bought up the media. Media oligarchy. When people get misled and they forget the important functions, they focus on these entanglements instead of focusing on the important aspects of society, like the infrastructure. I mean, look at what we did before the world wars. I mean, we had a Great Depression. What did we do? We're going to pull ourselves out of this Great Depression by building dams, by building bridges, by building interstate highways. Well, China is doing that right now. They are the quintessential Americans.
Do you know, I read in the Financial Times, I can't verify it, you know, and you know my motto, I always want to say this, I don't care if people agree or disagree with me. The motto of the Trends Journal is think for yourself. These are the facts that we have, this is the way we see it, you use your own brain and you decide. So I read an article about 2 weeks ago in the Financial Times, and they had said that in 2 years, between 2010 and 2012, China used more cement to build infrastructure and real estate than the United States used in the entire 20th century.
There's an interesting offshoot to this discussion. Shouldn't, I think, just be passed over with complacency? It's the largest producer of the yellow metal of gold worldwide. But what people may not be aware of is that they imported the entire global output of gold last year. They don't export any gold on top of that. If they know something that we don't know, and they're certainly importing so much gold, are they preparing for a currency implosion?
I think that most intelligent people know that the currencies are backed by nothing. And that we've had record low interest rates, and there's going to be a financial panic of sorts when interest rates go up and the economies go down. The only thing, look, the GDP numbers came out for the last quarter, and they were in the negative territory. And you could blame it on the weather. And well, you should. This is the worst winter back east that I've ever remembered in my life, and I'm no kid. But when you look at Europe, when you look at China, you have the Chinese housing market this year is down some 24%. There's no recovery in Europe. You look at the OECD forecast coming out, and they're showing negative growth. So even if the economy ticks up a little bit in the States on GDP growth, what's going to sustain it? Nothing. So what they're doing is they've debased the dollar by printing so many of them, and at record levels we've never seen before, with interest rates at all-time lows for never in the history of the country for this long. It's unprecedented.
Are you aware that there are more dollars circulating outside of our shores than within our shores, which I think is an incredible vulnerability should the world suddenly lose confidence? They seem to be doing every day in the U.S. dollar. You know, if we see a mass repatriation of those greenbacks,
well, you see, that's the problem. You have China's holding what? About 1.5 trillion of them. How do they? But how do they turn them in?
Well, they buy up businesses. Yeah, they're going around the world right now buying up commodities and precious metals related, anything with substance to recycle away those dollars.
And that's what they're trying to do. And that's why one of the stories in the Winter Trends Journal was Chinatown, top trend for 2014, and they're buying up the world. And now you're looking at the United States, by the way, now trying to make a push into Africa because China's in there so deeply and keeps getting in deeper. And so the United States is now using this Nigeria incident as a reason, and AFRICOM, C-O-M, which should be AFRICON, it's the United States military now expanding bases in Africa. So, and then when I was talking about Libya before, let us not forget that there were over 30,000 Chinese working in the oil industry in Libya before President Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, launched his, quote, humanitarian mission. So there's threats of China becoming more and more of a global economic power as the United States does the business of war. China is in the business of business.
Gerald, as we wrap up here, there are just so many pertinent topics today in the Trends Journal. Share whatever you see as most relevant for our listening audience, maybe any other socioeconomic trends that you'd like to leave today with the audience.
One is stay tuned what's going on in Ukraine. And there's no one I respect more geopolitically and economics is than Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who was the former Assistant Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan. He's also a contributor to the Trends Journal. And I would suggest that anyone that wants to know the story of Ukraine, go to paulcraigroberts.org, as well as subscribing to the Trends Journal. Because all we're getting now is propaganda about Ukraine. There's a civil war going on. It's not going to have a happy ending. And it's destabilizing the region beyond just the Eastern European region. You already have a volatile situation economically in Europe. You don't need more destabilization. So I fear that this could spread out of control. And again, we have the timelines and how the propaganda has set it up to make this look like it was a Russian deal when, in fact, it was done by America. And the videos are all there of our Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, on December 13, 2013, at the National Press Club, talking about how Ukraine has to follow the path of the IMF and that they're Europeans. And she has a sign right behind her, sponsored by Chevron, and then put the pieces together. Just a week ago or so, we heard that R. Hunter Biden, that's Vice President Biden's son, has been appointed to the largest energy company in Ukraine, Burisma Energy, B-U-R-I-S-M-A, along with Secretary of State John Kerry's stepson, Christopher Hines' business partner, Devon Archer, also appointed to Burisma Energy. So this thing is spinning out of control, and the bottom line, again, it looks like more dirty dealing on the level of how can I make a buck?
Well, you've heard the saying, follow the money. It sounds like follow the oil money.
Follow the oil money, and It's dripping right down into the White House. There should be outrage. Instead, the State Department says these are private citizens and they're highly qualified for these positions. So I figured out, sure, out of 7 billion people on Earth, Biden and Kerry's son-in-law's stepson's partner are the most qualified people out of 7 billion to be on Burisma's Energy's board of directors.
We always appreciate your thoughts here. It's cutting-edge stuff. It's the Trends Before the Trends Journal.
History before it happens.
And we're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
Thank you. And the website's trendsjournal.com.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with KunkerChange.com. I was surprised and pleased this week to see a very bullish article on gold written by Ave Gilbert of ElliottWaveTrader.net appear in mainstream media on the homepage of MarketWatch.com. It was titled, "The Next Great Bull Market, Gold, $25,000. There have been a number of articles and discussions appearing lately, each with their own methodology and rationale for calculating the future value of gold. This article began with a simple premise by asking, what if someone approached you in the year 2000 when gold was $250 an ounce and said it would be trading at 8 times its value a decade later? That's exactly what happened. In September 2011, gold topped at $1,921 an ounce. In fact, the author of the article, Ave Gilbert, called a top of $1,915 in August of 2011, missing the actual top by just $6. He thinks gold could make another similar run over the next decade plus, with the price of gold futures surpassing $25,000. Ave describes himself as the staunchest of gold bears the past 3 years, but indicates he will be switching sides and moving strongly into the bull camp, especially after what he calls the next and final decline, which will likely take place over the next half a year. The next half a year is going to redefine the meaning of conquer change on many fronts. We'll see what China has up their sleeve relative to their currency and physical gold. We'll see what the IMF has up their sleeve relative to special drawing rights and gold. And if we end up getting surprised or shocked on those or other fronts, we may end up seeing what the U.S. has or has had up their sleeve on the gold front. Only time will tell. But when you can't give mining companies away, when you can't give gold and silver away, when the urgency level to finalize anything mining-related is at or near zero, when the staunchest gold bears are about to switch sides in the spotlight of mainstream media, you know that capitulation is near or is already here. Intermission will be concluding shortly. and we will be resuming our feature presentation of the 2008 Economic Collapse and Great Reset, Part 2. Fasten your seatbelt. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.